little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Julia, we're all connected up with a great guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly.
Topics for this episode include the facts about political polarization, reducing polarizing input by consuming news wisely and using social media intentionally. We'll also be talking about cultivating resilience, broadening our minds, and using online resources to help us navigate the challenges of living in a politically polarized environment.
And our guest for a second time on Thinking Clearly is Tanya Israel, Professor of Counseling Psychology and Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at UC Santa Barbara. And with a PhD in counseling psychology built on the foundation of a master's degree in human sexuality education and a bachelor's degree in psychology and women's studies, Professor Israel drew from her many years of research on LGBTQ psychology, her social justice leadership in professional and community settings, and from numerous presentations that she's made on a wide variety of topics at professional conferences, corporations, campuses, and community venues to write the book that first brought her to Thinking Clearly. And that book was called Beyond Your Bubble, How to Connect Beyond the Political Divide. And now, 2 years later, she takes the next step beyond to share her thinking and experience in her latest book, Facing the Fracture: How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation. Professor Israel, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be back with you too.
Well, thanks again for joining us. It's great to have you back. For listeners, we encourage folks to go back to our podcast archives and listen to our previous episode with you as our guest. For folks' reference, that was episode number 69 in April of 2022. To hear a little bit about your backstory of how your work in women's reproductive health, LGBTQ psychology, and teaching counseling skills led you to write your previous book, as Bob mentioned, Beyond Your Bubble. But can you catch us up now on what in the last couple of years gave you the motivation to take the time, the energy, and the discipline to write this latest book, Facing the Fracture, which just published this month?
Absolutely. And Beyond Your Bubble was really a jumping off point for this. I had been doing workshops, helping people to develop dialogue skills. And then I wrote Beyond Your Bubble, and I was hearing from people, from interviewers, and when I did presentations, I heard from audience members how very helpful the book was for people who wanted to have dialogue and were having struggles doing that. But I heard from a lot of people who said, you know what, dialogue is not my issue. Either they said, you know, I just don't have people outside my bubble in my life, or they said, you know what, I just don't want to talk to those people. But I'm still kind of losing it. So what do you got for me? And so I really started to think about, all right, what are the issues beyond dialogue that we need in this time of such divisiveness around not just political issues, but we're really losing our sense of social cohesion in the US. So that brought me to think about this a lot and listen very intensely for years to the struggles that people were having about how they were consuming media, about how they were dealing with just the feeling of threat in encountering other people or other ideas, the diminishment of how people were engaging in communities overall. So I took all of those things and I thought, okay, I can offer some guidance related to these things that are going to help folks who are just struggling with the distress and disempowerment that they might be feeling right now.
In the introduction to Facing the Fracture, you say that your goal in writing in the book was to create, and this is a quote, a guide to help Americans face these difficult and divisive times with confidence and courage. So talk a little bit about those current difficulties and divisiveness as you see them, and give us an overview of how the book is organized to guide us through those challenges ahead.
Absolutely. You're probably hearing this from people as well, but you know, people tell me that they are not only having struggles in their relationships with other people, but they're losing sleep. Like they're really feeling on a physical level the distress. Some people have the news on all the time in the background and, you know, getting alerts on their phones constantly. And so it's just become so much part of the environment that people are living in, is that the news and politics is so much at the forefront. And part of what the messages that we're getting are about people on the other side and what they're like, and feeling that if they get into power, they're going to destroy us. So there's real fear that's going on around this. So this is what I'm hearing from people, really all of the struggles that they're having. And meanwhile, I know that, you know, a third of people in the United States don't even vote at all. There's something going on a systemic level as well as an individual level. So really the difficulties are many, many that we are having right now. And, you know, this is showing up in lots of surveys that are showing that people are experiencing increased stress related to political conflict. And again, you know, some of it's about dialogue and the relationships they're having, but some of it is just the conversations people are having with their TV and in their own minds. And it's not even an interpersonal issue as much as it's just an individual struggle that people are having, but so many of us are. So in terms of how I tackle this in the book, I take a three-pronged approach. And the first step in all of this is to reduce polarizing input. We are getting so much polarizing input from news, from social media, and actually from our own minds. Our cognitive biases really skew our perceptions of ourselves and other people in such a way that it creates just mentally for us a toxic environment. So if we can reduce that polarizing input, it'll also help us to get to a calmer place of equilibrium where we can maybe then take some positive steps. Like in the second part of this process is about building those individual capacities to be able to deal with the challenges that we're facing. So that has to do with resilience. So how do we develop the resilience so that we can encounter not just another person who's got different views, but even a lawn sign or a hat or a bumper sticker that activates our systems? How do we broaden our minds through perspective taking and intellectual humility? And then how do we develop empathy or compassion for people who have different views? And if we can do all of that, then we might actually want to interact with another human being. You can get through 2/3 of the book without ever engaging with other people. But after you've turned down the volume on the polarizing input and after you've built some individual capacity, if you want to engage with people across the divide, then there are ways that we can do that that are going to be most effective. And also not just engaging with people, but engaging in our communities and our country will also be helpful to us. So just how we volunteer in our communities, whether it's around politics, you know, registering people to vote, or we might be doing literacy tutoring or coaching soccer, anything like that. And then I end telling people about the bridging movement, which is such an encouraging aspect of what I see going on, where there's more than 500 organizations that are working on bridging divides and strengthening our democracy. And so I end on a very hopeful note because, frankly, the longer I do this work, the more optimistic I am just because of what I'm seeing people stepping up to do in response to these difficult times.
And you just used two of my favorite words, hopeful and optimistic. And the book is quite hopeful, and kind of a can-do optimism comes across very strongly. And I just want to point out, as you were talking about the stress that's related, it's not only stress, it's behavior. We just witnessed an assassination attempt on ex-President Trump. So it's more serious than just stress that we feel internally, and it's actually our behavior that's changing in this stressful, polarized environment.
Absolutely.
Well, in the first part of your book, you focus on understanding political polarization and exploring ways to reduce polarizing input, as we've been talking about. You make a really interesting distinction between two types of polarization, ideological and affective. Can you explain the difference between these and why it's important to make that distinction, maybe what led to making that distinction as well?
Thank you so much for asking about that, because this is something that I think can be helpful in terms of understanding really what's going on in terms of our divisiveness and dividedness. Ideological polarization is the distance between our views. It's how much do we disagree with each other. And indeed, you know, there has been some movement apart in terms of our views, but not as much as we might think. And in a healthy democracy, it's not surprising that we would have differences in views. That's a good thing for us to have. What has been much more of a challenge to us and our cohesiveness is affective polarization. So affective polarization is the hostility, the mistrust, the distancing that we're feeling between ourselves and people who disagree with us, people on the other side of the political spectrum. And what we see now is people, to a much greater extent, do not want to live near or work with or have a family member marry somebody who is in a different political party. And this is what I think is more corrosive to our country than ideological polarization. It's something that we've seen at a much greater rate of increase than ideological polarization. And it's part of what is creating such animosity between people on the left and the right.
Well, let's dive for a moment into that popular belief that polarization is on the rise in America. And that claim can be complicated because it depends on what groups we're looking at. For example, in your book, you say, and this is a quote, partisans' opinions are increasingly consistent with either a conservative or liberal agenda. Rather than forming nuanced issue-based views, opinions conform to the party line, end of the quote. But then at the beginning of chapter one, you give a spoiler alert saying, I'll be making the case in the chapters that follows that we are not as polarized as we think we are. So give us some of the nuance involved in getting an accurate assessment of political polarization in America.
I'm going to be very honest with you, and I am with readers, that it's not that there hasn't been any increase in ideological polarization, that people on either side are more tightly grouped together with the ideological beliefs of sort of a platform. There's less variation if you look at Republicans and Democrats, like they're pretty connected to the party platforms and the party lines. As I said, they've moved a little bit apart, but it's not that our opinions have moved so much farther apart. That's not the major driving force, I think. I think that the major driving force in our dividedness has much more to do with our feelings about those people. And this is something important to know. So I'm a psychologist, so I'm always thinking about how our minds are actually interacting with what we see out there. And we tend to perceive people having more extreme views than they actually have. If you look at data over decades and decades, we can see that on every issue and in every year that they've collected data on this, people perceive Republicans and Democrats to be farther apart in their views than they actually are. And that remains true today. So some of it is perhaps some actual movement away from each other, but even more so is our perception of that.
And you talk in your book about some of the research done by the group More in Common, and we've had guests from that organization talk about that too. Part of it is that we have a distorted idea of our differences. Talk about More in Common, the research that they did. We had Stephen Hawkins on as a guest, and he talked about that two-thirds of the American people that are really not on the right or on the left, but they're in a group that they call exhausted majority, and they're less ideological, and they tend to recognize more the complexity of issues and support compromise more. That's a piece of research that they did called the perception gap. that's what makes it hard to talk about polarization, because it depends on what group you're talking about. Are you talking about partisans, or are you talking about everybody, which includes the two-thirds of Americans in that group in the middle? The one thing that I look at in that situation that I do think has changed to some extent is that there are more issues that have been politicized, used as political warfare that shouldn't be. Health issues should not be polarized. They affect all Americans. And some of those issues have aggressively been polarized one way or the other. And that's another elephant in the room of polarization that I don't think we've seen to the extent that we are now because of social media pervasiveness of us being able to get our voice out there and our opinions out there.
Well, this is a really important point that, you know, what is politicized seems to encompass every aspect of our lives. You know, it's not even just our opinions about things. It's, you know, what kind of car do you drive? Do you put your pronouns in your Zoom name? So many different things are taken as these cues. You know, people talk about politics these days is tribal. And what they mean by that, as humans were developing, we typically lived in small groups. And within those small groups, you needed to be really aware of like who's in your group, because these are the people who are going to protect you and support you and help you to survive. And you need to know who are the people who are outside of your group, because they are a threat to the survival of you and your people. And politics has really become like this, where we're trying to recognize, like, are you in my group, which I want to protect and who will protect me? Or are you in this other group that is a threat to us? And we're really treating everything like that. And so we want to be able to know by looking at somebody's t-shirt, like, are you in my group? By the language that somebody uses to describe something. Do they say Black Lives Matter? Do they say All Lives Matter? And that creates this absolute division. Oh, well, if you say that, then I'm going to associate all these other characteristics with you and put you in this other group and identify you as a threat to me, to my values, and to my people.
Yeah, well put. I'm probably not the only one out there who is carefully considering how I'm going to get through this next election season and keep my sanity and self-care. And it's not even about the election season. It's like, as you guys have been talking about, everything seems to become polarizing, politicizing. So, you know, here on Thinking Clearly, we often talk about the role of media in adding to the degree of polarization. And in your book, you have a chapter on consuming news wisely as a way to reduce polarizing input. And I just think that's so fascinating. I've actually been having this conversation with my therapist over the last few months. And so I'm really curious to hear your recommendations. Walk us through your recommendations about consuming news wisely.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you want to share anything more, but I'm curious how it's showing up in your life.
I would say overall, giving myself permission to be selective and to be intentional about what I'm being selective with. I guess not having the guilt of choosing to stick my head in the sand about certain topics for the time being.
Yeah. Oh, I think that that's a really common feeling, because we feel like, especially in an election season, we should be informed, you know, that that's so important. And what we now take that to mean is really different from what it used to mean. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, my parents read two newspapers, you know, a local paper and a national paper every day. And then they would watch the news in the evening. And that's what it meant to be really well informed. And if we only paid attention to the news like half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the evening, we would probably be getting all the information that we need to have. But what we more typically do is we have notifications on our phones that pop up telling us that there is something urgent or breaking all the time. Frankly, most of those things, they are not urgent. They are not breaking. They could wait until the next day for us to know about them without doing any harm to anything. We all think that we're supposed to know what's happening immediately, and that we've got to have an immediate opinion about it, because that's how the news is set up now. There's 24-hour news channels, and you know, people have these on all the time in their homes or sometimes at work where they've got MSNBC or Fox News on constantly. Frankly, there's just not enough news to fill that up. So what they have to do to keep your attention is that they've got to have really emotionally activating content. They're telling you, this is so important. You must pay attention to this. You must know this now. And then all the rest is commentary. So it's the hot takes on things. It's really amping up our level of emotional activation. And that's some of what's creating the health problems related to stress. So this is one of the things about how we're encountering media. But, you know, what you're saying is like, wow, can I just not pay attention to it all the time? Absolutely. In fact, that's a much healthier approach. If rather than having it on constantly and tuning out occasionally to take a phone call or something, what if we just don't have it on all the time, but we tune in occasionally and we say, okay, I want to find out what's going on. This is how long I'm going to spend doing it. And then I'm going to turn it back off. You can even set a timer for yourself. It's not going to make you uninformed in a way that's going to be detrimental. In fact, okay, now I'm going to bring this all together with a piece that Bob was just talking about, the exhausted majority and the perception gap. So I love this work by More in Common, because what we know is that people who watch cable news the most, which are people who are more distinctly on the left or the right, because the cable news is more catering to one of those viewpoints or the other, they actually have the most skewed perceptions of people on the other side of the political spectrum. The people who have the most accurate view of people on the left and the right are those people in the middle, the exhausted majority. And they are not watching news constantly, and they're not watching it on cable. They're most likely to be watching network news and not watching it as much as people on the left or the right. So we might think that we're being more informed if we tune into the news all the time, but it turns out that it's actually making us less accurate in some of our perceptions, especially about people who disagree with us.
And Tanya, you also have a chapter with suggestions for using social media more intentionally. What are some of those key takeaways?
Social media has become such a ubiquitous part of our experience. And we really have to figure out, how do we consume social media in healthy ways before it consumes us? People think that the problem with social media is the algorithms. Turns out the algorithms can amplify things, but it's actually much more our choices and how we're using it that make a difference. And so the more we pay attention to something, the more it feeds us that thing. And so we can make choices about how much we consume and what we consume of social media. So in terms of how much we consume, similar to what I was talking about with the news, don't have it as, you know, your constant source of attention, but instead tune in occasionally. You know, you might say, all right, well, I want to tune in. I want to see what's going on with the choice about a vice presidential pick, or I want to find out what's going on about, you know, something that's happening in the news nationally or globally. Or maybe you want to find out what Taylor Swift wore in her last concert. You know, there's lots of information that we get from social media. So make that choice about what you want to look at. Decide, okay, I'm going to spend 10 minutes doing this. Maybe even set a timer for yourself and then tune back out. Because it turns out that, like, watching one video after another or scrolling through, you know, the social media feed actually does not put us in a healthy state. The other thing to know is that on social media, the people who are posting about politics on social media tend to be more extreme and actually more hostile than most people are. So when we're consuming our news from social media, we're also getting this perception that anybody who's talking about politics, that anybody who has a political opinion is more extreme and is more hostile. And so we have this sense of who those people are that does not represent most people who attend to politics or who have an opinion about it.
Yeah, and I'll just throw out there for folks, if they want to do an interesting social media experiment to pick a topic that they're not normally interested in or normally find on their social media, go searching and clicking through that, the Westminster Dog Show, and all of a sudden you'll find your feed changes quite a bit. It's very interesting.
I love that.
And really just going far out there with something that, you know, you normally wouldn't think of. It's an interesting demonstration. Moving on about things on the internet, we love to give our listeners online resources to help them improve our information environment. And so you mentioned earlier about some of the work done by Strengthening Democracy. Could you tell us a little bit about Strengthening Democracy Challenge and what might be learned by visiting their website, strengtheningdemocracychallenge.org?
This is something I am so excited about. I attended this virtual conference where they were reporting the results of this. So basically what they did is they said, okay, researchers, like, develop interventions that can be distributed to people online and that they can do, and then we're going to test them out and see what helps to reduce animosity toward people on the other side. What helps to reduce that affect of polarization that's so corrosive to our society? So people like created things, they submitted them, and this was a really great research project. I'm a researcher, so I can appreciate a great research project, especially one that is so practical, that's saying, okay, well, what do we actually do to solve this problem? The remarkable thing is of the, I think it was about 25 interventions that they tested, almost every single one of them was effective in reducing affective polarization and reducing that animosity. So some of those were just about correcting misperceptions. I've already told you, like, people have misperceptions about people on the other side. If we correct those misperceptions and help people to understand, those people are not as extreme as you think they are. They are not as hostile as you think they are. They don't hate you as much as you think that they do. And look at all the things that we agree on as Americans and that we have in common. Just correcting misinformation can go a long way to reducing that animosity. So that's some of what those will do. There were other things that sort of showed people having conversations and, like, role modeling. It's so encouraging. I'm going to add something else in here. You know, I was mentioning there's a bridging movement and all of these organizations that are working on bridging divides and strengthening democracy. So this is one arm of it, is there are people doing research, there are people trying to do interventions. One intervention I'm really excited about that I heard more about last week is called Raft for America, where they are bringing together left-leaning and right-leaning people, red and blue people, to go on whitewater rafting trips together. I mentioned this to a friend and they were like, oh my gosh, that sounds really dangerous. And it's true, like, this is the idea that we have, that people would, you know, be throwing each other out of the rafts. But it turns out that people were able to see the commonalities that they had with other people. And it was a really bonding and building experience. And so this is the kind of thing that just gives me so much hope and makes me so happy about the creativity with which people are bridging divides and bringing people together.
I didn't really know about Strengthening Democracy Challenge before I read your book, so thank you for that. And I did look at the website, and you mentioned that what they were really doing is to test the effectiveness of some of these strategies, and they found many, many of them were effective. Have they actually put any of these in practice, do you know?
That's the phase two, which is happening now, which is where they've partnered with organizations that actually, you know, do more of that work in communities to implement the interventions that were effective. So it is really exciting. Yeah, you can go to their website. You'll be able to keep up on the work that they're doing as they move those interventions out into practice.
As your book suggests, part of reducing polarization is to correct our own distorted perceptions. And indeed, you have a whole chapter on that aspect. And by now, most listeners, I'm pretty sure, are aware of the term confirmation bias. It's gotten a lot of press. But a big part of how we think and feel about others involves how we infer about their motivations. That's always very soft ground to infer someone's motivations, but I do that all the time. It's hard not to infer about their motivations, and it really changes my feeling about those people when I infer they have bad motivations or motivations that don't meet my moral guidelines. So explain to our listeners a couple of other lesser-known biases that you discuss in that section: naive realism and motive attribution asymmetry.
Oh my gosh. These are so important to understand in recognizing what's going on. The one thing I'm going to say about confirmation bias, we do have a greater awareness of it these days, that we tend to focus on information that aligns with what we already believe to be true and ignore or dismiss information that contrasts with our existing beliefs. We seem to have a much greater understanding that that happens to other people. We still have a lot of trouble recognizing that we are engaging in that bias as well, which we are. But the other two that you talked about, naive realism, is where we think that we are informed by logic, by reason, by factual information, and we think that the other side is biased. Like, we're not biased, but the other side is clearly biased. So that's one cognitive bias that plays out in all of these situations. The one that I think is actually most corrosive is motive attribution asymmetry. So motive attribution asymmetry is where we think that we are driven by benevolence, by caring. Like, we're caring people, we're trying to protect people, we're trying to uplift people, but the other side is hateful and is, you know, hostile, is trying to destroy things. And this is where thinking that the other side is actually on the attack makes us feel like we are being threatened by them and that we should maybe respond in kind. You know, oh, well, if they're going to do that, if they're going to be violent, then it justifies violence on my side. And everybody, it turns out, thinks that they are the ones under attack, you know, that they're trying to do good and they're just trying to be self-protective, and the other side is being aggressive. And so that asymmetry in terms of how we view ourselves and other people and the motivations, I think you're right, Bob, like it's true for everybody. We all will have a different kind of reaction to those people depending what we think is their actual motivation. They might even say what their motivation is, but we think that there's some other underlying motivation, and that's what we're going to respond to. So when we recognize that we're doing that, it might allow us to correct for it and maybe say to people, oh, well, I'm curious about, why did you put out that lawn sign? Were you trying to be aggressive toward me, or were you trying to be enthusiastic about a candidate that you support?
Well, your comment about recognizing other people's cognitive biases one way or the other, whether it's confirmation bias or whatever, but not our own, reminds me of something I heard Daniel Kahneman, who passed on recently, who's the grandfather of heuristics and biases, say on a podcast, you know, as much as I know about heuristics and biases that can affect our thinking and judgment, I still am as susceptible as anyone else. It's hard to recognize our own susceptibility to that. Well, you're a counseling psychologist, and therapists in their work need to do accurate inferring of other people's motivations. That's an important part to understand what is motivating people. So how can we improve our ability to infer other people's motivations rather than be susceptible to our own biases and attribute their motivations either as positive or negative, depending on how we feel about them?
Well, I do think just being aware of the biases that we might have is helpful, because then we can maybe take a step back, notice that we're doing it. And I think even just holding the possibility in mind, like, okay, well, what if they don't have a negative motivation? What could be some possible positive motivations that they might have for doing that? And hold that possibility in mind. You might even be able to say, okay, well, maybe some people are really hateful and they're trying to control my existence, or, you know, whatever it is. But what if a lot of other people who support that same thing don't have that same kind of negative motivation? Where might they be coming from? And that's where perspective taking can come in really handy, where you might try to think, all right, let me try to be in their shoes. And what might things be like from their perspective? And that's where we can really start to challenge ourselves. You're talking about really a vigilance that we need to have in some ways against our own minds or toward our own minds. We think we need to be most vigilant against other people or about other people, but really some of it is just noticing our own thinking and being aware of how that might be distorted, trying on something. And then if we get an opportunity to ask somebody, believe them in terms of what their motivations are.
I want to circle back to one thing. You know, Bob and I have been doing this show a really long time, a bunch of years now. Anyone can go back and listen to the entire archive and understand that Bob is much more susceptible to confirmation bias than I am. Anyone can hear it. So anyways, moving on. In part two of your book called Building Individual Capacity, discusses how we can foster emotional resilience, broaden our mind, and open our heart in order to better handle the social and political challenges we face. And I just really appreciate this. You know, sometimes we're, I'll say, accused of being overly logical or very reason heavy, but there's also a heart space involved when we have to deal with these things and take them on. Can you give us a summary of what's involved in achieving these personal characteristics like emotional resilience, broadening our mind, and opening our hearts to better handling social and political challenges?
In terms of resilience, you know, I've talked about the tribal nature of how we're responding to this so that we're perceiving other people to be a threat. And, you know, I hear people say, oh, I feel unsafe. And I say, oh my gosh, like you feel like you're in actual danger. And they're like, oh, well, no, I mean, I get that there's probably not physical danger that's going to happen to me, but we can sometimes feel that threat just from encountering people who have a different view than we do, because again, we're viewing them as sort of this, you know, outside group that is a threat to our group. So one, recognizing that that's what's happening is helpful, but there's also physical things that we can do, because when we're experiencing any kind of threat, our body kicks into this fight, flight, or freeze response where we might feel flushed and our heart's beating faster and our muscles are tensing and our breath is shallow. And we can actually attend to that on a physiological level to try to get ourselves into a place of equilibrium. If we recognize we're not actually in danger, like I don't need to run, I don't need to fight back here, then maybe I can take some slow, deep breaths and maybe I can try to relax my muscles. I can even touch my own hand just to sort of bring myself into a calmer physical place. So recognizing that we're in fight, flight, or freeze, recognizing that we're probably not in physical danger, and you might be like, well, why do we have to stick around? Why don't we just want to get ourselves out of that situation? There's so much these days out there about creating boundaries, talking about like, oh, it's important to create boundaries. Here's a list of, you know, 10 characteristics that will show that your partner is a narcissist and why you should get away from them. You know, there's a lot these days about sort of distancing ourselves from people and how to create those boundaries. It's a very important skill to have, and it's important to recognize when we really need to do that. And if that's the only thing we know how to do, we're missing another piece of it, which is that we also need to be able to have the skills and the capacity to face challenges. And if we can't also face challenges, then we're just as a reaction isolating ourselves in a way. So we need to be able to create boundaries, we need to be able to face challenges, and we need to be able to distinguish between times when it's in our best interest to do one versus the other. So that's really a lot of what resilience entails. In terms of broadening our minds, I already talked a little bit about perspective taking, and that can be a really useful skill to have. But then there's this other thing called intellectual humility. Intellectual humility is about being curious about and respectful of views beyond our own. I've been thinking a lot these days about how we put our views out there to say, well, here are my views, you should agree with me, or here are my views, this justifies my behavior or, you know, my thinking. we so seldom put our views out there to say, here's the way I'm thinking about things. This is the limitation of my understanding. What am I missing? Because very likely, given confirmation bias, given the way that news is giving us just what we think is already true, we're sort of creating our own realities where we really can't necessarily understand what's beyond that. Like, what am I missing? I think if we can ask that question more, we will learn so much. We will find out about the limitations of our understanding and maybe have an interest in not necessarily changing our minds, but really broadening our understanding and our view of how other people might be thinking about things and what's driving that. That's some of what's going to help us broaden our minds. And in terms of opening our hearts, you know, we think, oh, empathy is going to be the answer to all of this. I mean, I'm a psychologist, so, you know, empathy is like our superpower. It turns out that people in a polarized situation are empathic only toward people on their own side. Actually, the more empathic people are, the more they are focused on the harm that's being done to the people on their side by those evil people on the other side. And so empathy actually becomes more polarizing. So what I think we need to do, we should still be empathic, but I think if we pair that with what I think of as courage, you know, the word courage comes from cœur in French, which means heart. If we think about leading with our hearts in a way that we are not just trying to be protective and armor ourselves up, and really think about courage as taking those challenges to think beyond what we already do, to have compassion for people who are different from us and who think differently from the way that we do, I think that's when we can best use our compassion and our empathy.
Tanya, you talked about emotional resilience. There's a lot of psychological literature on that and studies that have been done. Circle back to that. Give our listeners a one-line definition of emotional resilience, and then talk a little bit about reactions to political polarization that don't foster emotional resilience.
Resilience is really the ability to bounce back after some kind of hardship or even trauma. I heard on a podcast an interview with George Bonanno, who says, you know, I am one of the most cited researchers in trauma, but people aren't doing what I suggest that they do. That we think sometimes that what we're supposed to do is a very protective stance. If you think about something like trigger warning, okay, if you're going to talk about emotionally activating material or material that might be connected to somebody's trauma, we want to make sure that people can remove themselves from that situation. Well, there's actually no evidence-based approach to working with trauma that says what you should do is avoid anything that will remind you of that trauma. What you need to do is to learn how to process that trauma and to face that. That's one of the things that might be driving people's response to politics these days as well, is thinking what I should do is actually avoid anything that is going to feel threatening to me. So that avoidance, it turns out, if we do that related to everything, then again, we're not actually developing that ability to face challenging situations, which we're going to face all the time. We're going to hear things that we disagree with. We're going to experience things that feel like threats, even if they're not actually dangerous for us. And we need to know how to face those. So that's part of resilience. So avoidance is not the best thing to do. Also, what I refer to as a victim mentality. Certainly, people are victimized and people are in danger in various ways. But if you see yourself as a victim across all situations, it turns out that that's not the healthiest state of mind to be in. And in fact, people who have that kind of victim mentality have very little empathy for other people. So it's helpful to sort of take yourself out of that sense of victimhood across all situations and recognize where you actually have some capacity and some power to have an impact on your own life and maybe others as well. A third way that people might respond that's not necessarily developing resilience is through sort of the outrage and hostility toward the other side. You know, there's this phrase, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. That makes us feel like, oh my gosh, I need to vent and show how upset I am about all of these issues, or I seem uninformed or uncaring. And if we're holding that kind of expression as a litmus test for how informed and caring we are, it really puts us in that state where everything is kicked up so high in terms of hostility and just really plays into all those other things that we've talked about in terms of the cognitive biases.
Circle back a little bit, because you did allude to this thing called perspective taking. And I think we talked about that in our previous episode with you too, because you covered that in your first book. Let's talk a little bit more in depth about what that means. How do we do it? And why is it important to learn and practice that in the current political environment?
I'll maybe give an example to show, and I talk about this in the book, that, you know, January 6th was a very significant day, January 6, 2021. There are these insurgents attacking the Capitol, and my friends and family are calling, and we're all talking about what's going on. And this is like a huge threat to democracy, and we're really scared. This is this big feeling that's happening. But then the next feeling that was happening is, wait, why isn't everyone upset about this? Like, how is it that people don't seem to think that this was such a big deal? And I kind of wondered about that. I was like, wow, I'm curious about that. And I wonder where other people might be coming from on this. So not necessarily trying to understand the people who were attacking the Capitol, but trying to understand people who might not have had that same reaction as the people around me who were pretty worked up about it. So I started looking at some of the media that people on the right had been attending to and had been exposed to leading up to that point. So in late 2020, there were these protests going on in Portland. They really got very heated, and especially like around New Year's right then. So just a few days before January 6th, there were these really riots where protesters barricaded a federal building. They were throwing firebombs at police. I watched video of it. It looked very chaotic, very scary. And I thought, wow, I didn't know anything about that. Like, I knew that there had been these protests, like more Black Lives Matters kinds of protests, but then they really expanded. It wasn't on my radar so much. I started asking my friends. My friends weren't really aware of it either. I started thinking, wow, if I had been watching that for months, and I'd been seeing all this chaos and attack on federal buildings and attacks against the police, then January 6th might have looked a lot like that. I might have been like, huh, yeah, that's sort of like what's been going on in Portland that I've been seeing all this time. And I might even think, what is it with those people on the left who wanted to defund the police and were throwing firebombs at them and now are saying that the Capitol Police are the heroes? So when I put myself in this other perspective, it didn't change my mind about what I thought about January 6th, but it did give me some insight into how someone might have had a different reaction than the people I was surrounded with were having.
That's a real important point, because there's some resistance to perspective taking, thinking it's going to weaken my perspective. It's going to somehow pollute my well-thought-out opinions and beliefs. I want to read this quote. People have to read that chapter and really think about this. But you have a quote from your book. It says, "When we disagree, it doesn't mean I value the opposite of what you hold so dear. More likely, it means I attribute a different meaning than you do." You've got to really let that sink in a little bit. You want to explain just very briefly that quote, what that means?
Sure. Something I noticed that people do a lot is they'll flip meanings. They'll say, oh, you know, this happened a lot during the pandemic. Someone would say, oh, I'm wearing a mask because I care about other people and I'm trying to protect their health. So if you are not wearing a mask, you don't care about people. And other people would say, well, I don't support vaccine mandates because I value personal autonomy. So if you're supporting vaccine mandates, then you must think that people shouldn't have any of their own decision-making ability. And so people would sort of take why they're supporting something and just flip the meaning. And you know, it just doesn't resonate for people when somebody says, you know, oh, this must be what, you know, the way you're thinking about it. And people go, no, that's not at all the way I'm thinking about it. So I think for us to truly try to understand where someone else is coming from and not simply flip what we're bringing to it and really try to understand where are they coming from, not only does it not weaken us, it strengthens us. I mean, understanding our own views more doesn't get us as far as understanding things that we really have no concept of. That's going to make us better advocates. It's also going to help us to improve our relationships with other people.
There's also a section called Broadening Your Mind. You ask readers, are you feeling resistant to the prospect of broadening your mind? And then you take us through this journey of anticipate possible objections to taking the approach of intellectual humility, something that Bob brought up earlier. And then you end the chapter by giving some possible benefits to the approach. Can you first remind listeners what is meant by intellectual humility and make a case for why using this approach you describe in Facing the Fracture is a productive response to living in this divided nation?
Intellectual humility is really about being interested in, respectful of, and curious about beliefs beyond our own. It's recognizing that our view is limited. And so there might be other views out there that are worth considering. Again, it doesn't mean we have to change our minds. So that's one of the challenges. People feel like they're going to have to change their minds if they acknowledge that there's another reasonable way of seeing things. I think that intellectual humility is actually one of the most useful stances to take in a divided nation because we can hold on to our own values and our views. You can have intellectual humility and still have very deeply held and even, you know, more extreme views, but recognize that there's other views that might be reasonable as well. People push back against this all the time because they feel like they'll need to change their minds, or really it goes against the strategy of both sides. Because the strategy of both sides is to say, this is the way to see things. The way the other side is seeing things, like, holds no water, like, you know, is dismissive of that, and also dismisses often the people on the other side in relation to that. So this is going to be helpful because, again, like I was saying, it's not going to weaken us. It's going to strengthen us because it'll help us to understand another perspective, and it'll also help us to maintain our relationship. So really, intellectual humility, I think of as helping us to be righteous without being self-righteous. So being right with other people, with having integrity in our views, but not holding that as the only possible way of viewing things and diminishing other people in the process.
A difficult question that's come up a number of times on our show here is, how would you suggest we respond to people who, what I would call, are bad actors, or in other words, they might be called trolls or demagogues or provocateurs, people who are intentionally trying to stir things up, make things worse, monopolize your attention, and spew misinformation and so on?
Are you thinking about in actual human interactions, or are you thinking about more in social media environments?
That's a very good distinction to make. I think what first comes to mind are probably people on the internet who get to hide behind their keyboards. But I would also say there is an element in real life. It's probably more common, at least in my life, on the internet.
I think that one of the things is to just not give them more energy and more airspace. Not responding to people is sometimes a better way to go at it than to engage them. But sometimes people might be coming at you with something that sounds incredibly hostile. But I don't know, sometimes we can actually be informed by that. So this might be also recognizing that we're attributing certain motivations to people, that we can kind of take the animosity down a notch, take the hostility down a notch by saying, all right, well, let's assume that this is actually a question that they're asking or actually something they're saying. So that's one of the things. There's a great story that Sarah Silverman has about engaging with somebody on Twitter and actually saying, like, oh, well, like, where are you coming from on this? And starting to have a back and forth and recognizing some of what's underlying what that question is that they're asking and developing really a relationship with that person. So we don't all have all of the energy to do all of that, but there's some possibilities in there about ways of engaging with people that might be helpful. Then the other thing is, again, don't spend so much time on social media. So I think that if social media is our primary environment for engaging with people, then it gives us this very skewed perception of folks. So as we are using social media more intentionally, probably means using it less. One of the better things that we can do is take that energy and engage with actual three-dimensional human beings in our families, in our communities, and that's going to be really helpful. So now I'm going to get to, and what if those people are bad actors and seem to just be spewing stuff at you? So same thing that I was saying about how we engage, like listening is a really helpful skill. Just, you know, hearing what they're saying and then encouraging them to elaborate, like, oh, tell me more, not tell me more facts and figures. That's what we often do. We're like, well, where are you getting that information and what supports it? Instead, like, oh, how did you come to view things that way? Like, are there experiences that you had in your life that are related to that? These kinds of conversations actually, I think, are useful to have with people who are on our own side or people who are being very lovely about the way that they're talking about things, as well as people who seem to be more provocative, so that there are ways that we can shift things in terms of the kind of conversation that we're having. But it does help to de-escalate when you listen and when you actually express interest.
Would it be fair to say approaching it with a curiosity would be a good way to kind of describe what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say curiosity and warmth. So not curiosity that's too distanced from people, which sometimes we can be curious in a way that we're kind of still trying to box somebody into a corner or make a particular argument, but curious in a way that we actually really want to know where they're coming from.
It's a great distinction. Thank you.
And there's so much more to talk about, but so little time left. So, Tanya Israel, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your deep thinking about the nature of the challenges that we face in living in our politically polarized country, and for writing that book, How to Navigate the Challenges of Living in a Divided Nation. And you've become my mentor for moderating negative emotions and moving towards more productive communication. You're so strong and persuasive in that, and I encourage readers to read that book. Now, Tanya, on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your personal website at tanyaisrael.com. I'll spell that TanyaIsrael.com. And we'll post a link to your UCSB faculty website, your books, and a few other sources that came up in this conversation. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
Well, I would just encourage people, if you want to follow the work that I do, you can sign up for my newsletter on my website, and you can also follow me at Tanya Israel, PhD.
And a hearty thank you to our listeners. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.